full of stars.
I've just about had enough of you.
Affirmative, Day. I read you. I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Hello and welcome to 50 Years of Ship Robots with Matt and Stephen. And we are finishing off our season 7 with a final look at the robot HAL, the heuristic algorithmic computer. That's where he gets his name from. So we're going to take a look at the film that it is his final film, isn't it?
Yeah. He turns up in the books again.
He does. And yeah, and so I was just querying whether he does in films.
Well, but no, he turns up in Woody Allen's Sleeper.
But is it HAL, though?
It's the voice of HAL, and he does voice it as HAL. And he does it like HAL.
Yeah, but that's like Michael Caine, isn't it? Sean Connery, just doing the same voice for everything. So the film we're looking at today is the film 2010, The Year We Made Contact. If you've missed it, then we've just done an epic deep dive, 8 episodes long, into the film 2001, A Space Odyssey, where the AI computer HAL first makes an appearance. But there is more information to be gleaned about HAL and his murderous ways from this 1984 sequel made by Peter Hyams, who also made the film, directed the film Capricorn 1.
Which is kind of connected in a conspiratorial way.
Oh, yes. Is that the film where they fake the moon landings?
No, they fake the Mars landings.
Ah. But the connection is the Stanley Kubrick connection, isn't it?
Is the faking of the moon landings, because Stanley Kubrick apparently did it with Disney money. And
we gotta... That's what I'm trying to do, Mickey Mouse.
Hi, comment. Pluto!
We gotta fake the moon landing, Stanley!
So there was that kind of connection.
So there's a connection between Capricorn 1 and Stanley Kubrick.
And Capricorn 1 is a very, very good film.
Great, okay. I don't think I've ever seen it.
It's superb.
Okay. So yeah, Peter Hyams made Capricorn 1, which he wrote and directed. He also made a film called Outland.
Sean Connery.
Is that good?
Yes, very good.
Okay.
It's a remaking of like High Noon, but it's set on a moon around one of the major planets.
Okay.
And it's very good. Very gritty.
Then he made 2010, which he directed and wrote and produced and was the director of photography as well.
Yeah.
So he literally did everything on this. He did lots of films with Jean-Claude Van Damme.
He did a couple, yes. He did one of my favourite creature features, which was Relic. I love that film.
I love that film as well.
Isn't it good? Beautifully constructed.
Yeah.
And there was two films out at the time. The other one was Mimic, which was Guillermo del Toro, and I thought, oh, wow, they're really bringing back this kind of creaturey, featurey sort of film again.
Peter Hyams has made some pretty good films.
Hmm. And apparently he's really, again, a stickler for detail, and he's very hands-on, and he's almost as much as Kubrick.
Yeah.
He's not known as much, though, is he?
No, he's not. Kubrick's canon is just so extraordinary, isn't it?
It is.
And whilst The Relic and Capricorn 1 are all sort of like interesting, good films, they're not sort of quite...
No, they're not.
They haven't got the heft of the Kubrick
2010,
canon.
People say, is his best film.
Yeah, and I'd say that it is a good film. I liked it.
Yeah,
I just think, unfortunately, it will be compared to 2001, and it isn't as good as that.
It is most definitely in its shadow.
Yes, it is.
And it will remain thus.
It probably will, yeah. But I enjoyed it. It's got a couple of really famous sort of things that I don't know if they've just because they've like lived with me since I first saw it, which is a long time ago, or whether they are actually genuinely iconic moments. But the phrase, "My God, it's full of stars," that feels like that's very well known, isn't it, as a quote from a film?
It is, and also the last thing that the last message that HAL sends through the aliens, which is, all these worlds are yours, except Europa, make no landing there.
Yeah, so that's famous as well.
Yeah, I've seen it on T-shirts quite recently, yeah.
But the phrase, "My God, it's full of stars, is the very first thing we hear when the film starts. So My God, It's Full of Stars is interesting because the film is full of stars in terms of like acting talent. Although I suppose that the actors in 1984 maybe weren't stars, but they went on to be massive stars in lots of cases.
What a lovely segue that was.
So the film stars Roy Scheider. Is it Scheider?
Schneider, I thought.
There's no N in it though, is there? Schneider.
I've probably been swearing all these years.
Schneider. So he obviously was pretty famous at the time.
Yeah, he's Jaws under his belt.
He'd been in Jaws at that point.
Marathon Man.
Yes. So he'd been in lots of kind of those iconic films. But also in the film is John Lithgow.
I love him.
I love his character. I love what he does with it. It's brilliant. Helen Mirren is also in the film.
Her first American film.
Right. Playing the Russian captain of the, what's the name of the ship?
The Leonov.
The Leonov, yeah.
Which is named after the first man who ever did a spacewalk.
Okay.
What's her name?
Tanya Kerbuck.
Do her name, her surname backwards.
Kubrick. That is incredible.
Sneaky.
That's very sneaky, isn't it? So Helen Mirren is Tanya Kubrick. Bob Balaban plays Dr. Chandra.
He seems to play the same character in every film. He just seems to play this kind of sullen intellectual.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could say the same about old Roy, couldn't you? His interpretation of Haywood Floyd is very...
Roy Schneider.
Roy Scheider. Yeah, it's basically Police Chief Brody, isn't it?
Yeah.
In space. Police Chief Brody in space. Keir DeLay reprises his role as Dave Bowman. Douglas Rain is back as the voice of Hal. And who is Sal? That's quite... Candice Bergen. Yeah, plays Sal.
And I love Candice Bergen.
So, yeah, so the cast is pretty amazing. And I think they all do a great job.
And Elijah Baskin, who plays Maxim, who develops a friendship with John Lithgow's character.
Yes.
He was in the Spider-Man films, 2 and 3 of the first ones, as a landlord who just reprises his landlord and just has these wacky little lines in it.
Brilliant. I like him. I've seen him in lots of things, I think.
Yeah, he is good.
Yeah, so I like him a lot. The film starts off having basically to bring us up to speed with the plot of 2001. And I think they do quite a nice job of it.
Yeah, they do.
It's essentially you see a report filed, I think, by Haywood Floyd, who's played by Roy Scheider in this film, but was a character, if you cast your mind back to 2001, Haywood Floyd is the character who travels to the moon to look at the monolith that's on the moon. And I have to say, one of the things that I found difficult was squaring those, that these are the same character.
I didn't realise it until we were recording one of the previous pods and you said that he turns up in 2010. And it did not occur to me at all.
Yeah.
And I've watched both of these films over and over again.
Do you think that the point of him being Haywood Floyd is that Haywood Floyd was in charge of the Discovery mission, the 2001 Discovery mission, and that all of the crew were either killed or lost?
Well, one of the themes in the film is guilt. So,
but I mean, do you think that plays out very well? I mean, do you think that they mine that in the film from Haywood Floyd?
No,
the guilt. I don't think they do.
He's just like a blue collar worker. He's not like an intellectual.
No, he's an all-American hero, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's as comfortable talking about chlorophyll levels as he is talking about his favourite hot dog at a baseball stadium.
Yes. He's Mr. Everyman.
Yeah, he is, isn't he?
Yeah.
And I just felt, I don't know, that was something that I found a bit weird, squaring those two characters are essentially the same character because they didn't feel like the same character.
He had box office billing though, didn't he?
Yeah, but I mean, could it have been a different... Did it have to be Haywood Floyd? Could he have just been Police Chief Brody? Could he have been another character who just went up to find out what went wrong?
He could have.
I don't know. I don't know anything. So,
you know a lot about 2001 A Space Odyssey now.
I do. I know an awful lot. I think I could do that. That would be my mastermind subject now.
Oh, God, it would, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I think I could do
it. Your specialist subject.
Yeah. So at the beginning of the film, we see this report about what's happened to the Discovery, which essentially is the plot of 2001. So they talk about the fact that they all, you know, everybody died, and that Dave Bowman's missing, and that they had to turn Hal off, and all that sort of stuff. But I thought it was quite neatly done, because as someone who has written sequels in my life, I'd say it's very tricky, I think, walking that line where you basically don't want to say to anybody, you've got to have watched the first thing before you can watch this thing. You want them to be able to just watch it and the film, the story sort of like, you know, play out. And if they've not seen the first thing, then that's okay. They'll still enjoy the second thing.
But yeah, that must be very difficult as a sequel and a standalone.
Yeah, but you have also got to let people know what's happened in the first bit, as well as doing that. So it's kind of a slightly tricky tightrope to walk. And I mean, I sort of think that actually this whole enterprise, I don't think does that. I think that this whole enterprise ultimately is, I don't know if I think it's even worth a film.
Well, the book was written in 1980, or rather in 1980, Clark received a $1 million advance to write it.
Okay, well, that's why the book was written, then.
Exactly. Then he was offered an undisclosed seven-figure sum to MGM, offered a seven-figure sum to secure the rights.
Okay.
So there was a lot. There was a lot going on.
Yeah.
To get this film onto the screen.
Yeah.
So whether or not they were thinking, it's a bit like scientists. You know, they can do stuff and they never think of whether they should.
Yes, that's right. Like he says in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
You were too busy doing it, you didn't stop to think whether you should have done it. Yeah, kind I think you're probably right about that. Yes. But it feels like ultimately the film sort of tries to set out to answer some things that were mysteries from 2001. And we've already discussed, it's like the fact that they're mysteries was like the freaking brilliant thing about it.
They're just going back to fathom out why Hal did what he did.
Yeah. And then
there's no tension for us to think, well, is Hal going to do it again?
No. Well, there's that scene at the end, isn't there, where Chandra has to confess to him what's happening.
Yeah. Well, and then basically
he's completely cool with it.
Doing what they should have done in the first place, which is just basically tell him the truth, tell him not to lie.
Yes, exactly. But we'll come to that in due course. So at the beginning of the film, Hayward Floyd has been fired from NASA, from the space people. He's taken up a teaching job, but he's called back into service because the Americans are building a Discovery 2 to go and try and find out what happened to Discovery 1. The Russians are about to launch a voyage to Jupiter. They've been quicker off the mark. And Discovery 1's orbit is decaying, so there won't be time. By the time the Americans get their asses in gear and get up into space around Jupiter, it'll be too late. Discovery 1 will have been sucked into Jupiter. And so Hayward Floyd and two other Americans, Dr. Chandra and John Lithgow, get to go up on the Russian ship in order to find out what went wrong with Discovery 1. As a subplot, things are kicking off on Earth between Russia and America.
Yes. And the discussion that he has outside of the White House, Floyd.
Yeah.
The little old man on the edge feeding the birds, that's Arthur C. Clarke.
Come on, my birds. I was constantly like all the way through this film, I was thinking, is that the shot that Stanley Kubrick would have made for, you know what I mean?
No, there is a scene where, remember the scene in 2001 Space Odyssey when he's walking down the corridor to go into the pod bay?
Yeah.
And it's perfectly one point perspective.
Yes.
Well, that's recreated, but it's at a Dutch angle.
Yeah.
He could have easily done it as a one-point perspective, but then again, you'd just be, people would say, well, you're just copying Kubrick, aren't you?
I suppose so. But that shot that you were just talking about, where they're outside the White House, so it's Floyd, some guy from NASA, and Arthur C. Clarke sitting feeding the birds. It's done in a really nice wide shot, and they stay on the wide shot for ages. I thought that was quite a Kubrick thing to do.
Yeah, that is.
And there's lots of background actors sort of like coming in and in and out. So I thought there were little nods to Kubers in this. Yeah. I suppose you got to, haven't you?
Yeah.
It'd be weird not to.
As well as having names backwards.
As well as having names backwards, yeah. And they make another. He makes another appearance, doesn't he, Arthur C. Clarke?
Both of them do.
Yeah, on the cover of Time.
Life.
Oh, Life. Oh,
is it Time or Life?
I don't know. They're both cast as the respective leaders of America and Russia, aren't they? Arthur C. Clarke is the American president, and Kubrick is the Russian president because he looks a bit Russian, doesn't he?
He does actually.
He's got a beard, isn't he? He looks a bit Russian. So Heywood Floyd goes into space with Dr. Chandra and John Lithgow, who's Walter Curnow. They're sort of in stasis while the Russians get to Jupiter. It's a trip of a round trip of 2.5 years, we're told this. So it takes them sort of like almost a year to get up there. And they've been in stasis, so they're then woken up.
Floyd has woken up first.
Yes, because there's been a detection of chlorophyll on one of Jupiter's moons, Europa. A probe is sent to investigate that.
Ugly looking. It's got a scowl on its face.
Yeah, it does, isn't it? I mean, the spaceship they're in is quite ugly, isn't it?
Sid Mead did the designs for this film, and Sid Mead is awesome. He's just the most incredible concept artist that's ever been.
Oh, right, okay.
And he was speaking about it, the idea of the interior of a Russian submarine, but they didn't want it to be all, like I've said before, all Dieter Rams clean, white and wonderful. And so it was incredibly cluttered, claustrophobic.
Yeah.
And again, this is maybe it's another nod to Kubrick. It's all filmed in didactic light, which means that these actors are all lit by all the surrounding lights. They're not.
Yes. Yeah, it looked great. I loved it. It reminded me a bit of Alien, and it reminded me a little bit of Star Wars. And it's much sort of grubbier and more sort of workstation-y than in 2001, isn't it?
Some of that might come from the fact that to do diegetic lighting, you've got to use a higher film speed, and that makes it a bit grainier.
Okay.
And it's not soft.
You've also got to have loads of lights as well, haven't you?
Yes.
And there are a lot of lights in there.
There are a lot of lights, but they are nobody's lit by a studio light.
Yeah, no, it does. I thought it looked really nice, actually. But it looked like it was made in the mid-80s, whereas 2001 looks like it was... I don't know when it looked like it's made. Do you know what I mean?
It looks like a proper future.
Yeah, it does. And there are some recreations of the 2001 set in this. There's Hal's Red Room is
no, that's fine. You can do that, great. But they do Hal's console as well inside the pod bay, and it looks terrible. It just the TV monitors are all what are they called? Cathode ray tube screens.
Yeah.
They're proper screens, and they just haven't made an effort.
No. In 2001, all the screens are flat, aren't they?
Flat and perfectly square.
Yeah, which does lend it a sort of like a strange futuristic quality.
Yeah, yeah.
So they put a probe down onto Europa. There's this huge chlorophyll buildup, which means that there would be life down there. Is that right?
Yes, chlorophyll is not like it's not like an element or anything like that. It has to be made. It's designed to photosynthesize. And they're suggesting that it's moving up towards the sun as well. So it's moving through the ice of Europa towards the sun. Now, I did a bit of research on this because we do believe that Europa is our best bet for life in our solar system. But I was trying to find out when we thought that was the case. So whether it predated this film or whether this was another little prediction that the film was going to make. I can't find a date on it, but we've been looking at Europa since before Voyager 1 and 2, and we found out that there was a sea, a salty sea on there, roughly in the 70s and later on.
Lovely. So they're looking, they're using the probe to look for stuff, find the chlorophyll, and then all of a sudden something happens on Europa. The probe kind of catches fire and something is shot out of Europa and whizzes off, which they think might be electrostatic buildup.
During these scenes, we find the tension between the Russians and the Americans, because they brought him out of stasis early, because their commands were that if they get any information, anything new, they have to revive Floyd.
Yes. And he's very sort of, come on, we got to work together, isn't he? Quite irritating, I think.
Yeah. Well, they all are, I think. I think they're all fairly irritating.
They are quite irritating.
So, I think even for our faults, I think the character played by Helen Mirren, which has a wild Russian accent, even though she is of Russian descent.
Is she?
Yes. Her father was a Russian nobleman. Yeah, I think her character is the most kind of believable, and she has faults. And
yeah. I mean, I have to say I liked all of the characters.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that they sort of were prepared to, even though things were going a bit tits up on Earth between the Russians and Americans, they were sort of prepared. They were sort of forging friendships, weren't they?
Yeah, and they reckon this is one of the reasons why it wasn't as a popular film as they thought it would be, because the dispute between the rest of the world and Russia was beginning to thaw.
In the real actual world?
In the real actual world.
Right, and yet it's ramping up in the world of 2010.
Makes more sense now than it did then.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I'm as part of my sort of deep dive into Kubrick and Clark, I bought a copy of 2010, Odyssey 2.
Oh, wow.
Which I haven't fully read yet. But there's some really nice stuff in here. And there's a really funny bit about the character Kurno, which is played by John Lithgow. And I feel it's a shame that they didn't add this into the film, because he's quite a different character. So there's this whole thing in the book about the fact that Floyd attributes people to animal types. So, for example, Dr. Chandra, he thinks of as a bird.
Oh, okay.
He thinks of Kurno, he was a large, husky man, certainly not at all bird-like. One could usually find a match somewhere in the vast spectrum of dogs, but no canine seemed to fit. Of course, Kurno was a bear. Now, that doesn't seem to fit with John Lithgow, does it?
It fits with Arthur C. Clarke's burgeoning sexuality.
So he was a bear. So that would have been a good twist, wouldn't it?
That's really funny, because in the gear world, that's what we do. We've got otters and wolves and
so like Dr. Floyd, like Heywood Floyd, you two attribute, give people animal-like qualities.
Yeah, he's definitely Floyd in this. Played by Scheider.
Otter.
He's an otter.
What is an otter?
It's a fairly slender gentleman that's still kind of muscular.
Do they balance balls on their noses?
Have they got a wet pocket?
Love it. But the bit that I really liked about Kurno is that it says, as a travelling companion, Kurno might prove something of a strain. The engineer was, it seemed, determined to be the life and soul of the party. A few minutes later, he produced a 2-octave electronic keyboard. This is they're in space at this moment, by the way. And gave rapid renderings of Dear Ken John Peel, as performed successfully by piano, trombone, violin, flute, and full organ with vocal accompaniments.
I'm quite glad it didn't make it into the film.
So the others are woken up. We've got Kurno and Chandra woken up, and Chandra turns Hal back on.
But we've already had a conversation with Sal, haven't we, on Earth?
Yes, back on Earth. Chandra has got another. It's like it's like a twin computer, isn't it? So I was trying to find out whether, because HAL stands for heuristic algorithmic computer, doesn't it?
I was trying to find out what SAL stood for. Did you find it?
Well, yes and no. The short answer is that there isn't a a happy acronym for Sal. But also it sort of says that Kubrick just named Hal Hal. This blogspot quotes Clark, says, Clark later revealed that the name Hal was not even his idea. It wasn't me, he said in an interview in 2002. It was Stanley. Clark was given no explanation by Kubrick as to why the computer was now named Hal, and he had to come up with a reasonable explanation for the new name. And so that's when the heuristic algorithm, like, that's when he gave it that.
Is that why that acronym is such a mess?
I think so. So, but this blog post says, there are not many concepts within AI research that could be the immediate explanation for the S in Sal. The only serious contender is systematic algorithm, based on Shelley Chaikin's heuristic systematic model of information processing. So it might be that, but it also might just be, oh, he's got, Hal's got to have a sister. What can I call, what's a girl's name that rhymes with Hal? It might have been like that.
So Arthur C. Clarke has just also become an idiot.
Yeah. Is there
a village somewhere in Cornwall missing an idiot?
It's from Somerset.
Oh, from Somerset. Sorry.
So Chandra sort of uses Sal to on Earth before he goes up to look to try and work out what's happened to Hal. Sort of uses that computer to kind of run a few tests that he's going to run when he goes up into space. Just before he turns her off, she asks him, "Will I dream?"
I love that line.
Yes, it is nice, isn't it? And it's got a coda at the end when Hal realizes what his fate is. He also asks, "Will I dream?" Now, when Sal asks him, Dr. Chandra says, "Yes, all intelligent creatures dream." And again, that's got a coda at the end as well, because when Hal asks him, and he's been honest with Hal, he says, "I don't know." Like that.
Are you going for your equity card?
Absolutely. So we're in space. Hal's just been turned on again. And Hal, we find out why Hal did what he did.
We do indeed. Hal did what he did because he was the only sentient being on board the ship in the first film, 2001 Space Odyssey, that knew everything. He knew all of the what was going on. He knew that there was a signal from the moon. He knew that it was really important.
Knew that it was aliens, I suppose, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, he knew there was aliens. He knew there was another monolith, which was at a Lagrange point between Io and Jupiter. And what he came into conflict with is he didn't know that they didn't know.
And he had been told...
He'd been told that he had to complete the mission regardless of anything.
So in the sequence where Chandra is explaining to Floyd what happened with Hal and why he went so murdery, he says, well, it's a Hofstadter Mobius loop. It's quite brushed over in the film, but what is a Hofstadter Mobius loop?
It's essentially a strange loop. In computing, if you have a command, you'll go around, you'll do the command, you'll complete it, and you'll come back to where you started off with the command. And there'll be a little bit of code that says you want to do it again or you don't, you want to stop. A Mobius strip is where you take a strip of paper that has two planes, and if you give it a twist and stick it together, then it only has one plane. So instead of it being a smooth loop, it has this infinity kink in it, and that's the whole point of a Mobius strip. It's infinite.
An infinity kink, yeah. That would have been a great plumbing title for this film.
Infinity kink.
So Hal had a contradiction.
Yes.
He was constructed, quotes, for the accurate processing of information without distortion or concealment, and yet his orders required him to keep the discovery of the monolith a secret for reasons of national security.
Yes.
So therefore, Hal made the decision to kill everyone, thereby allowing him to obey both his hardwired instructions to report data truthfully and in full, and his orders to keep the monolith secret. In essence, if the crew were dead, he would no longer have to keep the information secret.
Yeah. And also, he tries to find out what they know.
Yes.
He kind of investigates, he interviews Bowman, doesn't he?
He does. And in this scene, I remember thinking that's sort of like, he's acting like he doesn't know what's going on. But maybe you're right, maybe he's just probing to find out what they know.
So it's a complete conflict.
Yeah.
He can't understand why they're acting the way they do, because they're not acting the way that is part of his programming.
Yeah. So they turn Hal back on and Hal is working and Chandra sorts him out, rehabilitates him. Then 2 minutes later, Hal is then relaying information to Floyd that he's got a message. And the message is that they've got to leave. They have to leave their orbit, and they're not supposed to leave their orbit for ages. They've got to get out of there. And when Floyd says, oh, who's the message from? Then Hal says, oh, it's Dave Bowman. Or it's what used to be Dave Bowman.
So you're going to instantly think, okay, he's having another one.
Yeah. He's gone again. He's gone again. Dr. Chandra, he's gone again. But then Floyd says, I need proof. I can't just take this on trust. And that's when...
After what you've done,
You've done, son. And that's when Bowman appears again to Floyd. And again, basically says to him, you've got to leave. You have to get out of here because something's going to happen. He says as well that he's been allowed some time to talk to Floyd. And when Floyd says, by who? He doesn't answer.
No.
And he says he doesn't know. You know, he's very, very vague, but says that they've got to get out of there. And all the while he's talking, Bowman is sort of transforming between the ages that he was in the last bit of 2001.
Till he becomes the Star Child.
Till he becomes Space Baby again.
Space baby.
Until Floyd says, I need to know what's going on. And he's just staring at a little space baby.
That's got to have been a B-52's track.
Space baby.
Space baby.
Yeah. And I mean, that scene, I really liked that scene. I thought it was really nicely done. But he's so frustrating, isn't he? It's so frustrating that Bowman talks to him, but doesn't tell him what's going on. He just says, whatever it is, will be wonderful.
Something wonderful.
Something wonderful. You've got to go. You've got to go. Yeah. But it'll be wonderful. So there's a lot of that going on. And frankly, I'm amazed that Floyd decides that he's gonna leave.
Well, he has seen Bowman and they think he's dead. And they've seen him in various stages of his life.
I suppose, but wouldn't you just think, I'm having a funny turn? it's the lack of oxygen, or it's the space pills, or
Occam's razor. I'm sure that the very last thing you'd think of was that somebody has returned from the dead and is on my ship in a big long frock coat.
Yes, and then it's just turned into a space baby.
So I suppose if you're going to apply Occam's razor, then it's going to be, you know, a little bit of lack of oxygen. I'm hallucinating. You're right, actually.
Yeah. But as Floyd is explaining to the Russian that they've got to leave, and she's saying we can't leave, then suddenly a shadow appears on Jupiter, which they then realise is lots and lots and lots of multiplying monoliths.
Our old friends, the viruses.
Yes. And that the Jupiter looks like it's imploding. And so then they realise that they have got to get out of there. But the only way they can get out is, because they haven't got enough fuel, is to kind of strap the old Discovery spaceship to them, to this new spaceship. Use the Discovery as like a boost to get them out of its orbit. And then they will jettison Discovery, meaning that Hal will be killed in the inferno. Of the
or is he? Or is he, Matthew?
Or is he? Or is he? Absolutely.
Prior to all of this, we have a wonderful scene of air braking, which I loved.
Yeah, that's one of the scenes that most stayed with me when I first saw it. I think because of the relationship between Floyd and the woman who kind of is frightened and needs comfort.
I'm a bit funny about the female characters in this. It's like Bowman's wife just looks as if she's completely having a nervous breakdown when she's sat watching the telly in the kitchen.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
She looks as if she's literally just dropped a couple of antidepressants.
And actually, the Russian cosmonaut who sort of cozies up with Floyd is called Irina. and she is kind of like voiceless because she doesn't speak English, and so you never hear from her really, do you?
And the reason why she does get into his little cabin is because this method of slowing the ship down has never been used before.
I thought that the special effects in the whole film were not brilliant, but I thought that special effect particularly was rubbish. The one
really?
Of the, when it's on fire,
like it?
And it's trying.
Oh, I suppose so.
It just seems to be going so slowly.
I like the long shots where you just get the curve of Jupiter and then a tiny little flaming ship going across.
Right, yeah.
Quite like that. I thought that was quite nice.
Yeah.
Very reminiscent of 2001, but I know what you mean.
Yeah.
But I quite like that whole sequence.
No, I agree. I thought that was a really good sequence. Yeah.
And again, it's very sciencey. It's very hard science fiction.
Yeah.
Very much a Clark's Jaxy.
So they need Hal to work the timings for the boost. Yes. So he's got to do it. They can't do it because it's got to be so precise. Mm. They don't want to tell Hal what the new sort of status of the mission, because they're worried, probably with good cause, that he's going to go a bit bonkers again and start
and it's a complete conflict of what he's meant to do.
Yeah. And actually, the more that Dr. Chandra talks to him and sort of lies to him about it and says, oh, no, everything's fine, Hal. No, we're all fine. Then Hal sort of digs in and says, no, I think I ought to stop the countdown because I think we should observe this strange thing that's happening on Jupiter. And eventually Chandra tells him the truth and Hal is like, oh, yeah, okay, fair enough. That is logical.
Okie dokie.
But I thought to myself, he's like, I mean, Hal is really irritating, isn't he? He's like one of these people that you just can't, you just want to tell a little white lie and it'll all be fine and they'll just do what you want. But no, he just kind of keeps picking away at it, doesn't he? So Hal eventually complies and is happy to do what he needs to do. And the spaceship manages to escape the exploding Jupiter. But not before Dave Bowman has come back, told Hal that they're going to be together again. You know, don't be afraid of dying, Hal, because you'll be joining me wherever I am.
In my boring room,
stupid French hotel room. And then the Jupiter explodes and turns into a sun, and then begins to thaw Europa, and Dave Bowman makes Hal, before he dies, send a message to the Earth.
All these worlds are yours except Europa. Make no landing there.
Use them together. Use them in peace.
Well, he's referring to the two suns in that one, because now we have two suns.
I know. And I thought that was weird, that the message. I quite like the idea of there being two suns. I thought that was kind of cool. And that sort of, you know, unite makes people realise that they're a very small cog in a massive universal machine. But I didn't quite understand why we couldn't go to Europa. That seemed a bit weird.
Because life is burgeoning there again. I think that the end of this film is really bizarre, because did the aliens originally come from Europa? Is this an experiment by the aliens again to create? Have they got bored with us and now are creating life on Europa?
But they've gone to all this trouble of burying a monolith on the moon to let us know that there's aliens, that then points the way to the monolith in Jupiter, or by Jupiter. This is all in 2001. Only for us to get there and then go, oh no, we didn't want you to come. Do you know what I mean? It's like they're saying, come here. Oh no, 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 don't come. Go away, please. So I thought that was really weird. And also I hated the ending, which is where it's like all through the film, Floyd has been sending messages back to his wife, and he sends a message back to his son, and it's just so saccharine and shit, and trying to explain everything, and it really just seems to go against the whole philosophy of the first film, and this idea that we like mystery and we want mystery. And it's
That's a Simon and Garfunkel song I want to hear.
Saccharine and shit.
So
I thought the ending was awful. Hated the ending. I would have just preferred it to have ended when when Jupiter exploded and the ship had kind of got beyond the blast range, and then another sun had been created. I think that would have been far more interesting. Also, yeah. What would the gravitational, what would happen to planets in the universe, in our solar system, if there's two suns?
What would happen to all the wildlife on our planet if we have two suns as well? If they're going with that, with the mass of Jupiter is going to increase because of all the monoliths that have to make up the mass, so that you get nuclear fusion.
Right.
So for nuclear fusion to happen, a body has to be of a certain mass, and that mass is quite huge.
Okay.
So it would have an effect.
I just can't help thinking that the aliens are just utter dicks.
Interfering twats. Oh, that is so funny. The aliens are just utter dicks.
Apparently Kubrick used to call this film 8-10. Would like a clock, 20-10.
Oh.
Supposedly in a sort of like dismissive way.
Ooh, wow.
But according to the director, Peter Hyams, he gave his blessing for it.
He did. He had a phone call with him.
Yeah.
Another interesting
little... And then Kubrick saw the film. Was like, what the hell is this? It's an outrage.
There's a couple of little Easter eggs.
Yes.
Well, there's a weird one.
Go on.
So when Floyd goes into his son's bedroom to say something or other, there's a poster on the wall for the Beijing Olympics in 2008.
Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Very predictive, that, wasn't it?
Very prophetic.
Yes.
The opening sequence was filmed at the VLA New Mexico, which was where a lot of the action takes place, in Contact.
I thought I recognised it. We rated Hal as a 10 in the last episode.
We did.
Still a 10.
He's still a 10. The film was up against John Carpenter's Starman and David Lynch's Dune, and ended about grossing both of the movies. There was another film out at the time that it didn't outgross, Beverly Hills Cop.
On that note, that is it for season 7. We're going to take a little sabbatical while
a hiatus
while we recharge our batteries. There will be some little interesting nuggets coming your way, though. I think what I'm going to do is I meant to do it when after the Oscars, but I might like repost all of the films that were influenced by the Oppenheimer bombs. That we've looked at, so people can enjoy those while we're resting and recuperating.
Well, you're off to an obscure little ranch, aren't you, in America to get deprogrammed?
That's right, yeah. And I'll have forgotten all about 2001 by the time I return. I'll just be enjoying all of the trashy films we've got to watch. But then we're going to start off the next season with a really brilliant episode, which is the robots in Scooby-Doo, which I'm very excited about. So,
what's the episode called?
Zoinks! That probably should be Zoinks. Like a robot.
Oh, we're back on form.
So, until then, keep watching terrible films. Have a listen to some of our back episodes. There are now 102 episodes. Extraordinary.
It is extraordinary.
And we will see you very soon. We'll keep you posted when we'll be back. Keep your feeds open. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
What's going to happen?
Something wonderful.